that matters. How we cut and curl and bleach and trim and shave has always said a lot about us. It's personal and very visible. But in 19th century America, how hair was worn came to signify big things, not least class, race, even trustworthiness. With large and naturally glossy black whiskers, wrote a New Orleans journalist in the 1840s, we always associate honesty of mind and firmness of purpose. He called the study of character via hair whiskerology. A couple of centuries later, the historian Sarah Gold McBride, a lecturer in the American Studies program at the University of California, Berkeley, has written Whiskerology, the Culture of Hair in 19th Century America. Sarah joins me now. Sarah, what happened in the 19th century to make people suddenly so conscious about hair?
So the big change of the 19th century, as you noted, hair has always been important. People in cultures and communities all across the country, probably since humans had hair in the first place, have been drawing meaning from that hair. But what changed in the 19th century, beginning in the 18th and really solidified by the 19th, was an emphasis on biology, that hair mattered because it was biological. In the colonial period in the pre-United States, the English colonies, hair mattered for its style. Whether a person chose to grow their hair long or cut it short, or whether they wore a wig, and if so, what kind, these kinds of stylistic choices mattered, and they might communicate, for example, religious identification. But in the 19th century, what changed was biology, that hair was suddenly understood not just as this external decorative thing that is similar to clothing or makeup or jewelry, but that hair was of the body, that it grew out of the body. And therefore, increasingly in the 19th century, it was understood really to be a body part. And I don't use that metaphorically in so many of my sources. People talk about hair as a part of the body, that, for example, to have a haircut is to have an operation. To be frequently getting haircuts is to have your hair kept bleeding by the barber. So hair was truly understood to be this part of the body, integral as an arm or a leg or an ear or a nose. And in so doing, this emphasis on hair's bodily nature made its biology so significant that it could communicate core biological truths about the person from whose body it grew. And moreover, some of the hairstyles that had been meaningful in previous centuries, all of a sudden they are assigned these biological inevitabilities. For example, that only white men could grow beards, that no one else was capable of growing a beard other than white men. And, you know, if you saw a few hairs on the chin or the cheek of a man of color, well, that wasn't a beard after all, that was something different. So these stylistic choices, whether it's facial hair or long hair or short, become freighted with the weight of biology. And in so doing, the gravity and the significance of hair becomes so much stronger in that century.
And the fact that only white men could grow beards said a lot about the power of men and white men.
Yes, exactly. Yes. The beard is actually where this book began. When I was a graduate student, I was researching bearded ladies. I was curious about freak shows, which were an enormously popular form of entertainment in 19th century America. And in the doing of researching bearded ladies, I learned just how important beards became symbolically as these markers of white masculinity and in so doing of political citizenship in the 19th century. That there is almost no facial hair to be found in the United States prior to the 1850s. And then from about the 1850s until the first decade of the 20th century, all of a sudden, beards everywhere, mustaches everywhere. The sort of illustration of this ubiquity is looking at the presidents. So the first American president to have facial hair was Abraham Lincoln, who's elected in 1860. And from Lincoln's election until William Howard Taft leaves office in the 19-teens, only one president is ever elected without any kind of facial hair. Every single other elected president has a mustache, a beard, sideburns, or some combination. So yes, the beard becomes this marker of masculinity, of whiteness, and therefore of political power in that second half of the century.
Now, Sarah, please, let us just not neglect bearded ladies.
Two questions here. To talk about bearded ladies.
Two questions here. How is it that women from time to time can have a full beard? And why do you think they were objects of such fascination? You know, why were they in freak shows?
So the first question, there is just some small percentage of women who grow facial hair. There are quite a few studies in contemporary medicine of trying to quantify the percentage of women who grow some amount of facial hair. And the numbers range. Some of the studies look just at white women. Some look at Black women or women from other racial groups. But there is something, I think, if I recall correctly, it's something about 10 to 20% of women grow some kind of hair on their faces. Now, of course, hair removal has been available as a technology for a long time. You know, the kinds of technologies have changed, certainly, but there are recipes for hair removal in cookbooks and other kinds of personal care guidebooks for a really long time. So there's just some women just grow facial hair on their faces still to this day, certainly. And in the 19th century, the very first bearded lady was named Madame Clafoulia. That was her stage name. And she came from Europe, and she was born with quite a lot of hair on her face, and it just continued to grow. And she came to the United States in the 1850s to perform with none other than P.T. Barnum, the most famous person of the 19th century U.S. and the preeminent purveyor of unusual people and unusual bodies. And she was such a sensation that she basically created almost this character, this archetype, that freak show after freak show all across the country, all of a sudden, have to have a bearded lady. By the early 20th century, the manager of one of these collections of unusual bodied people, it's called the Congress of Strange People, he says, a bearded lady, they're so expected. Every single freak show has one. That's why I liken it to a clown in the circus. It's sort of an expectation by the audience. So the bearded lady is a sensation as early as the 1850s. And what I argue in the book is that there is a way in which a lot of freak show characters, the kinds of reoccurring figures you'd see from show to show, many of them do trouble a boundary of some kind. So, for example, people with albinism, people who were albino, so they sort of trouble a racial boundary between whiteness and Blackness. People who are little people or dwarves trouble a boundary between youth and adulthood. So on the surface, we might categorize the bearded lady as troubling a gender boundary. But what I argue in the book is that it's more than that. There's something very historically particular about the way that the bearded lady never hid her beard. She was not trying to remove it. She was instead making money off of it. She was standing on a stage for all to see. She was celebrating it. And contemporary observers, men in particular, who were increasingly concerned about women, white women especially, pushing into realms of political and social life, trying to, for example, push for the right to vote, concerned about women not knowing their place, not staying in their place, and they immediately, as soon as she arrives in the U.S., are comparing Madame Clafoulia to women's rights activists, saying these are two groups of women who are not knowing their place.
Wow. Wow. Now, meanwhile, American men stop shaving. Now, why? Why do they stop shaving?
It's a great question, and it's one that I don't think there is a single answer to. There are some scholars who've looked at the popularity of facial hair, first mustaches, and then beards in Europe, especially in France and England, which are two of the sort of cultural authorities for early Americans in particular, with elements of scholarship and style and culture. So there's a way in which we might see sort of a trend that begins overseas and comes to the United States a few decades later. That probably explains some of the beards. There are some famous bearded celebrities that visit from Europe to the United States for a speaking tour that might have influenced some men's decisions to stop wearing beards. There's also some evidence, especially in the South, a lot of the barbers of the colonial period and early 19th century were Black men. And there's a way in which some men seem to have felt by the middle of the century increasingly nervous as the political strife over slavery grew increasingly urgent, a little bit nervous about having their throats sort of bare to a black man with a razor. And so there's some evidence of white men who thought, well, I'll just try to shave myself. I don't need to go to the barber anymore. But then this is an era before safety razors and before easy access to good lighting and good mirrors and good water. And so some of these men probably found it's actually terrible to try to shave yourself at home.
But Sarah, this could go to the virtue of those people who have better things to do with their time than shave.
Yes, I think some of it too is wartime. Some scholars had attributed all of the beards to the Civil War, saying, oh, it's so hard to shave when you're on the battlefield. And certainly there were probably some men who grew facial hair for the first time at war, but there's evidence that it actually predates the Civil War. And that's why I find that probably the likeliest answer is it's a combination of many different things. And then there's this kind of snowball effect with more and more men wearing beards and writing all of these books and pamphlets and articles about how beards are so great, that they save you time, they save you money, they save you trips to the barber, and a beard has all these health-giving powers too. They write about the protection of the throat to keep you from getting sick, and of course all of this isn't tied up with masculinity, that comparisons between the beard and the horns on a deer, for example, or the mane on a lion, that these are signs of masculinity, and that American men really need to show their masculinity on their faces.
But they've always been signs of wisdom, haven't they? Prophets had beards.
Yes, there are. They're so true. There is this long history of beard wearing, and a lot of these contemporary, the 19th century writing about beards will turn to these ancient examples and say, think about all these wise men of ancient life who wore beards, and shouldn't we now again start to emulate their decisions to wear beards as they did. There is this sort of, it's not perfectly cyclical in any kind of predictable way, but there is this, the human history of beard wearing in the Western world, as we know it, has been some periods of beardedness and some periods of barefaced, and it's sort of gone back and forth over time. And the U.S. Was founded in an era of largely barefacedness in England and the new U.S. both. And so the beards and the other facial hair forms really just come back in the mid-century.
And there has always been a social contest over hair length.
Yes. Yes, it's so... This is also a really interesting element of early American history, is that we have all these iconic illustrations and paintings of famous early American figures, the founding fathers, George Washington and his colleagues. And they're always wearing these long white wigs. And then within a few decades, American men, by the beginning of the 19th century, American men are wearing short hair like it's a uniform, as if it is assigned to you when you become an adult. It is almost, it's really, really challenging to find any white men, and the evidence is more scant for black men, but black men as well, almost any men wearing their hair long. This is not the case for indigenous North American men, who many of whom continue to wear long hair throughout the 19th century. But for white men, for black men, and also for indigenous men who lived in white communities, short hair was so uniform. But what I found when I started my research is that there wasn't really a good explanation for why. We could say why the wigs went away.
Why is that? Why did we give up those stupid wigs?
So it's probably, again, a combination of things. I know that's not the neat answer we would love to have. But in part, I think there is a lot of scholarship suggesting that part of the decision to stop wearing wigs is about the revolution. It's about the wig symbolizing British aristocracy, symbolizing the king and the crown. There's a source I have where an American man says, the wig is no different than a crown, and we don't allow crowns in America, so why should we allow wigs either? That it was this material object that reminded early Americans too much of England. And it's true that other goods that were British in nature were also cast aside in the aftermath of the revolution. But I find that an incomplete explanation. Because it's not all men wore wigs in the colonial period. There's actually, I think, a less, not very well-known fact is that most of our iconic images of George Washington, he's not actually wearing a wig. He is wearing his hair styled to look as if it were a wig, which tells you just how popular wig wearing was. But he wore his own hair long, and he had it powdered and styled and looked like wig styles of the period. So it's not simply the case that men stopped wearing their wigs. It's also that men like Washington himself, who would have worn long hair in a previous generation, are cutting it short. And what I found in my research is that this is really the more profound shift, that the rejection of the wig is part and parcel of this shortening of white men's hair. And an argument that to wear one's hair short is necessary for American masculinity. This is, of course, the moment where Americans are defining who is an American, who is a citizen of the United States, who has political rights, who should have the right to vote, for example, or hold office. And there's this argument that to wear short hair is a sign of a man's ability to be his own master. And this language of master, it's very racially coded. Of course, it alludes to enslavement, to enslaved people of African descent who are not their own masters. But there's a suggestion that to wear one's hair short is simple. It doesn't require a lot of time. It doesn't require a lot of labor. And it is a way to show that you have self-mastery over your own body and that you, therefore, have the right kind of masculinity to be a political citizen of this new nation.
On Late Night Live, I'm speaking to Sarah Gold McBride, historian and author of Whiskerology. Meanwhile, was there anything like similar controversy over the length of women's hair?
Yes, women's hair is long in for a really long time. There are biblical passages, biblical mandates that state women must have long hair. 1 Corinthians is the most commonly cited passage in the colonial period, as well as in the 19th century, where leaders of the church will say, it's very clear in 1 Corinthians that women must wear their hair long as a covering, as a form of a sign of their religious worship and their religious observance, and that it's not enough to wear a hat or a bonnet or some other kind of covering. The hair itself must be long. So long hair has this religious grounding for Christian people since the beginning of English colonization. The Puritans were especially, Puritan leaders are yelling about hair a lot in the 17th century. And they're very concerned about the hair care practices, the style of hair, again, not its biology yet. So they're saying 1 Corinthians is very clear, women must have long hair. It is given to them by God as a covering. And in the 19th century, we see this, again, this assignment of biological inevitability to long hair, claims that only women can grow long hair, that men simply cannot grow their hair long, a lot of scientific and cultural authorities begin to say. And not only is long hair on women a sign of their religious observance, it becomes also a sign of their femininity, this notion that of a kind of binary, really, that men should wear short hair because it is simple, it doesn't require a lot of time, you're not enslaved to, they would literally use these words, enslaved, you're not enslaved to your barber, to your valet, your personal care person. You're not enslaved to style. You have simple short hair, and that's because you're a man. And on the other hand, decorativeness, fashion, a lot of time and labor spent styling one's hair, that is appropriate for women alone.
But from China to the United States of America came men who wore their hair long. And that became a big cultural focus.
Yes. In the middle of the 19th century, after the gold rush in California, all of a sudden, this new group of immigrants began arriving in largely, mostly in California in the West. And these are men from China. And the Chinese law at the time mandated that men of Han ethnicity must wear their hair in a long length and in a style known as a queue. It's sort of like a ponytail or a braid that begins at the top of the head and extends down the back. And virtually all of the Chinese immigrant men who came to California in the 19th century were of Han ethnicity. And so they wore their queues with them when they came to California. And it's really striking. I looked at a lot of visual culture to study how white Americans perceived and received and interpreted Chinese men. And they were obsessed with the queue. They drew it in these fantastical fashions where the queue is flying through the air as if it has no gravity. It's there's illustrations of Chinese men doing acrobatics hung by their hair or being held up by their hair by an angry white shopkeeper or something. They see the queue as this signal that Chinese men are unassimilable, that they are alien racially, and that their masculinity is wrong too, that there is something effeminate or feminine about them. And there's other signs too that reinforce this this meaning that hair seems to transmit, that Chinese men largely don't have jobs as independent farmers or as shop owners, that they are working, as so many immigrants have done then and now, in lower paying jobs. And many, even California local laws made it illegal for Chinese people to buy land, for example. So they would do jobs that are coded feminine in white culture, like laundry or personal domestic servant, for example. So there are these other signifiers that suggest something is not right about the masculinity of Chinese men. But the hair becomes really this container for this whole array of almost irreconcilable assumptions about Chinese men, that they are, on the one hand, so effective at their work that they're going to put all the white men in California out of business. There's all this worker anxiety Chinese men are so efficient. So on the one hand, they're these almost like supermen, amazing workers. But at the same time, they are called effeminate or feminine or, you know, not masculine enough. And it's sort of, how do we reconcile these two visions of Chinese people at the same time, Chinese men in particular? And I see the hair as the one thing that kind of bridges those two assumptions, that the hair was long like white women's hair, but it was also drawn so strong, these examples of the hair, you know, holding the body weight up, of a Chinese person, that the hair is both strong and it signifies weakness, femininity and weakness in a way. So it kind of reconciles these different conflicting visions of Chinese men, all of which see them as decidedly outside of political citizenship.
A last issue in this immensely rich field. Scientific studies in the 19th century seemed to establish the fact that if you looked across the criminal population, there were far fewer blondes than black-haired criminals. Mm. And therefore, there was something kind of innately trustworthy about blondes.
Yes, the attempt to assign something meaningful in hair that could almost predict criminality. This is something that really becomes important to police detectives in major American cities in the final decades of the 19th century, that the United States is, over the course of the century, getting bigger, larger population, thanks to immigration and expansion. And cities are growing in these huge rates. And there's a lot of nervousness that when you go to a city or when you're in a city, that you don't know anyone there or you don't know how to know who to trust. And so, and moreover, crime becomes a preoccupation, that cities are dangerous havens for criminals who will take advantage of the anonymity and the mobility of city populations. And so, therefore, it's suggested that there's a lot of interest in trying to find some way to pinpoint a person who is likely to commit a crime. This is, again, we're in an era before fingerprint technologies or other kinds of identifiers of individual identity. And there are some use of photography to try to capture who are the known criminals, they would say, in a given city. But there's a lot of interest in the research by this Italian criminologist named Cesare Lombroso, who writes this book, The Criminal Man, who argues exactly what you just said, that if he counted the incidence of hair color among hundreds of criminals, and he controlled for the country of origin they were from, and then he found that black hair was the most common and blonde hair less common. Now, I think on its surface, blonde hair in general in most parts of the world is just not that common in adults, right? That there's a fair number of
Except in Scandinavia, perhaps.
Right, exactly. Except in Scandinavia. But in Italy, where Lombroso is writing, and in the United States, where his work is eagerly translated, blondness is simply not common in general among adults. And so to find fewer blonde people in any population is probably not a surprise. But there's something also important about black hair here, because the characteristics that he flags as inherently marking the body of a criminal, someone criminally inclined, someone born to become a criminal, a lot of these characteristics are racialized. They're the same kinds of characteristics that might be described, that might be used to describe a person of African descent. He would say, for example, they had crisply textured hair, or that their hair was black, for example. There's a suggestion, in other words, that there's almost something, you know, from a 19th century imagining of humans existing along a spectrum, a racial spectrum, in which white Europeans are at the top of that ladder, and for many Americans, African-descended people are at the very bottom. A suggestion that criminally inclined people were almost like they're sliding down that ladder of civilization, that despite their ancestry may be European, but if they are criminals, they're going to demonstrate the same bodily characteristics, the same hair in this case, as a person of African descent.
Oh, the pitfalls, oh, the horrors. Now, look, we're on radio, Sarah, and I think we should lay our cards on the table for our listeners. My hair is short and grey. Yours?
My hair is curly and brown, though increasingly grey as well.
Excellent. Good to know. The riches of this subject are just immense. Sarah, thank you. I've been talking to Sarah Gold McBride, historian at the University of California, Berkeley, about her book Whiskerology, The Culture of Hair in 19th Century America, published by Harvard University Press. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.